biz.
Dog biz.
You were listening to the first 17 minutes of Side B of Dog 01, BZ 04, Whackaroons Need Not Apply, by the inimitable Dog Biz. The reason that I faded it away is because we were chatting off air and then realised we were actually doing the stuff which we should be doing on air. And I was saying to Bob, I'm trying to describe the different ways. By the way, Simon Prentice and Gamma have now gone. Simon has driven
this
Gamma
home.
This
is the final heat.
Yeah, many thanks to them for coming along. That I was trying to define how...
Define the medium first before you make your target is how you assessed my approach.
Yes, I was trying to define our different approaches, and I was saying that Bob seems to have... a fairly objective, total view of different phases of planet Earth and society, and he lays that out as an explanation first of all. Whereas I go from my own reaction against things and wanting to articulate it, and then I was thinking, but these things do cross over because there are many other people's immediate reactions to the situation, which I go and try. You go to poetry readings, hear people get up and do poetry, or you read newspapers and authors write, and then I shy away from them. They haven't got it right. They're not expressing themselves correctly.
You're saying the same thing I'm saying.
So I start criticising them, and in order to criticise them, obviously what I have to say is, well, it's not appropriate to be doing that. You're actually repeating something, and you're not responding, and you're not there. And then I have to get a little bit sociological. I have to think about history, and I have to...
Explain it.
And therefore I come over into your territory.
Yeah.
But... I suppose what I'm saying is that I want to know where is the moment where you articulate your own expressive need for action and your indignation and your stepping out from simply being someone saying, but the world is like this and I can, you know, because when somebody says they've got a perfect descriptive system, I'm always thinking, yeah, where are you in this?
Yeah.
You know, because I was... if I look at a drawing, I'm always thinking, well, where is the artist sitting and how did they put the pencil on? And there was a body holding this piece of paper. And a lot of artists don't want to admit that. They try and produce a beautiful picture of a landscape which sort of floats from nowhere. And you don't know that. And this is why Cézanne is a revolutionary painter, because he made... Impressionism was fantastic. It gave people a... snapshots, these extraordinary coloured snapshots, which were so realistic, and once you shut your eyes a bit and all the flecks of paint went together, it was so vivid. But Cézanne showed that every time you put any paint down, somebody with paint on a brush was going there and there, making a decision. And so you got all this chopped, ugly, like, marks being made on the pain. And this ushers in the whole of modern art, of showing that this is actually a person putting the paint down. It's not objective.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting for the moment when you're laying the ground and everything. When are you going to admit that actually you are an expressive individual, one individual among millions, having your go, and that you're not, in fact, God?
I do that in my work off camera. I mean, I'm an intelligence agent. And that's actually, I've always said, the real artists since the late 60s are the intelligence agencies. And not the obvious ones, CIA, KGB or something, but the secret ones, which became known as Echelon in the 90s. You ever heard of Echelon? The agreement between New Zealand and the United States and Britain to monitor every bit of international communication. That's what Echelon does.
I'm shaking my head, so you can't hear that.
which way are you shaking your head? You're going, no.
No, I'm shaking my head. We nod.
Nod is yes.
Nod is yes.
Notting Hill Gate.
Notting Hill, yeah.
So the Shakespeare, the Great Refusal from Shakespeare. So my creative and expressive stuff is in interacting with my teammates in the intelligence molding of the global meme. So what appears to be my public role is me updating people on what happened up to, say, 67. So I have these known references that I publicly educate the people on, and that's just rear guard action. Hey, you guys, you're going over there, and you don't know you've already been replaced, and you're over there. So so a lot of what I say has nothing to do with how I live my life. Can you get that? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Now, the revolution is that when my personal achievements go on camera, which I said is going to be over the next 100 years, I make fantastic claims, and it actually happened, a lot of things I did. But those records are not released yet, and I don't want them released because they would be lost in the confusion. McLuhan said that Castro was an incredible politician because he used TV to be an educator, a warrior, and bureaucrat, and inspiration to the Cuban culture. He integrated everything. He took over the microphone, right? And nobody else was doing that, and he did it. That point of taking over the microphone, showing me being the massager, I don't want that apparent yet. So I'm talking about how the other people did it and explaining it so that you then can understand when I do go public what I'm referring to. So I'm educating, like Castro, the background to the play that's coming. So that's a long-term project.
Hmm. Well, I had this before about long-term projects because I immediately compared you to Anthony Braxton and to a poet called Alan Fisher, and they both propose incredibly ambitious schemas of their works and how they fit in. And I was saying, no, your response to art has to be, it's fractal, that you can tell from a phrase in Joyce that is fantastic. You don't need to be told, well, actually, wait, later on there's this and that and the other. And often these delaying tactics about an immediate response, but you can't get what I'm saying at the moment because tomorrow I'm going to do another symphony, and in that I'm going to, you know.
Wait.
And, you know,
now.
That fundamentally, that Braxton-Alan Fisher thing is, there's a good term for it, it's bullshit.
Right.
Because art's got to work. Straight away, you see a Wyndham Lewis picture or a Kurt Schwitters picture or a phrase by Joyce, and it makes your hair stand on end. It's fantastic. You know, by the texture. And these justifications about, well, this is my plan, listen, you know, are just, they don't excite me at all. They make me fall asleep. I can't stand them.
I do my art on the radio or whatever medium. So I am doing a medium. But people want to know, well, where are you coming from? Where are you going?
Mm.
So that's my explanation, but it's not necessarily
I don't mind. I just want good radio now, and I want insights now.
And that's what I do.
Yeah. And you're good. Yeah. When you're good, I really like it.
Yeah.
But the explaining the long-term Bob Dobbs plan makes him fall asleep.
Right. But that's, it's not relevant to you.
No.
I mean, you probably won't be around when I'm doing this. You'll be dead, long gone, maybe. Unless you get to know my wife and get treated.
Well, I've got some
healthy
means of carrying on. You see, I think coining ideas makes, you're holding in your hand my book Art Class and Cleavage, and in fact if you look at the back blurb, it actually has something about immortality in it.
In the top part.
Yeah, it's various things, and one of them is...
Well, do you want me to read it?
Well, yeah, you could...
Ben Watson's Frank Zappa, The Negative Dialectics
well,
of...
Yeah, well, come on, go to
okay, here it is. This new book is a defense of poetry, a rediscovery of Trotsky, a polemic versus or against Deleuze and Guattari, a manifesto of humanist Marxism, a satire on the Popsicle Academy, a materialist theory of immortality. So when I read that this morning, first time, I thought, oh, that's interesting. Mm. You know, this is what you do, interesting things, Ben. You get close to me.
There is a theory of immortality in it, but it's quite simple. It's that the idea that we die is the problem of individualism. And once we can find... I'm not talking about some, you know, the things that you talk about, some sort of biological continuation, which seems to me a projection from philosophy onto the biological body that I find quite grotesque. It's manipulative and not...
But I agree with that. I'm not just the opinion I'm presently explaining or using. Yeah. But go back. What's your immortality?
My idea of immortality is that if the knot of the personality could be untied, then death would lose its sting. Because we would understand how this whole thing being built upon the biological individual is actually something of a particular era in human development. And that when you understand that...
We can do it, we can become immortal while still alive, is what you're saying.
You understand the true immortality of what you are is your... contribution to the ongoing process, and that you can...
Now, a lot of people have that, and if Ben went to a convention of people who understood that, Ben would start saying, no, you guys got this all wrong. You don't understand that what you're doing is unconscious, and you aren't conscious of the principles you naturally feel. Everybody thinks they're contributing, no matter what they're
doing.
Of course.
You
have to think they're contributing.
Yeah, otherwise there's a certain sickness takes over. I mean, that's that projection towards the future and the sense of morals is absolutely inbuilt. Everybody thinks they're
so
contributing.
So distinguish your point from that.
Well, that the it's Boethius. It's Consolation of Philosophy that I'm saying.
Right.
And it's that...
That's Boethius, B-O-E-T-H-I-U-S.
That this tragedy so perceived of death of the individual... Mm. Is no tragedy at all. It's an absolutely necessary completion of what we are.
Yep.
You know, so it doesn't worry me at all. And I really admired the way Zappa was so prosaic about his own death and didn't go history.
And
on
he
it.
Said he didn't want to be remembered. Remembered. He didn't want
to
be dismembered.
That's interesting.
Remember, he said that? Isn't that a contradiction to the whole point you're saying that
probably,
you contribute something?
Yeah.
He didn't want to be remembered.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, he had this Francesco Zappa, his alter ego from the Baroque era.
Who did the same years, 63 to 88, which is amazing. 1763 to 1788 is...
Well, it's flourished, isn't it? Because they don't have his birth and death dates.
Right, but that's just the years of Frank's career, musical career. 63 to 88. Same years.
Oh, his career.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
200 years later.
Yeah.
Redunzel. We did it. Well, go ahead with anyways.
But when he celebrated Francesco Zappa, it was somebody who loved music and loved sex. And if he had those things, then the whole idea of posterity and all that didn't matter because he's been so concrete about what he actually wants now. If he can get enough of that, then what is this? And, I mean, I understand that as the desire for immortality and for fame and everything are... a product of sexual repression, that a very Christian and repressed society produces people who have to live afterwards because they're not really living now. Whereas if we could really live now, we'd be quite happy with what we got.
Do you think that people have... They act out their need for sex more today than it did 40 years ago? Don't you think society's evolved? I mean, people are into sex a lot.
They say they are, but I don't...
Again, there's been the critic. They've become the revolution.
I think there's a lot of misery. I think there's a lot of acting sex. There's a lot of...
Now, how would you know there's a lot of misery?
Because sex hasn't been separated from security and identity and, you know, that sex is not a pleasurable... It's
too many signs associated with it.
Well, it's... So survival is so bound up with it.
Yeah.
And of course, as biological human beings, as biological beings, you can look at animals and say, well, obviously sex and survival are related. But it seems to me that there are possibilities of a rational working out of what these drives could be and things that people want to do, which it wouldn't be that in order to achieve sex, you have to, like, build...
The signs towards it?
Well, you wouldn't have to have a... It wouldn't all be dependent on...
Of establishing something.
Yeah, of establishing what you are.
Goalless sex.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, goalless sex.
Yeah.
Well, when you're having good sex, it does seem to be, well, this is why we have life.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the Francesco Zappa point of view. It's, you're turned on to, there's a reality in it that's, it seems to be this separate universe you step into, and you are the center of it, and you become like nature. You're no longer got all these kind of mortgages and things here that will happen then, and then
or someone
planning.
Resenting that you had sex with other people, which may be the problem of Gail Zappa if Frank didn't help do the dishes enough, you know. The thing is, McLuhan said the most important thing in life is sex.
Oh, really? I never think of that as a McLuhanite point of view.
No, see, because you only know some Madison Avenue image of him.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is, I mean, Gurdjieff said the same thing. Sex is what we were, the moon controls the sex, and humans are controlled by sex. So sex is the being and release of life. It is the most important thing. But other people want that. So the confusion of relationships creates the philosophical quest.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it does.
Because you're communicating when you're doing sex, and others are involved. You're not alone. And then people, judge it.
I'm quite defensive of the stuff you do on your own as well.
Defensive? You mean supported?
Yeah, not...
Isn't it funny if I take it the other way? I'm defensive about doing things on our own.
Yeah.
That's a good Leninist
view. In fact,
view.
I've often thought that the whole of Frank Zappa is about justifying masturbation.
Yeah. I think so. But then on my album that was made by others, they took a line, television is the thinking man's masturbation is the thinking man's television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Masturbation is the thinking man's television. Because television is masturbation. So raw extension and rubbing of your tactility extended back to yourself. That's incredible. That's why everybody started screwing, you know, in the 50s, because television was reminding them of it or impelling them towards it. The Western version of tactility, sex.
Yeah, that's the word for it. And it's kind of an annoying word for it because it restricts it into something that isn't general enough.
The word sex is annoying.
Yeah, because it
It becomes S-E-C-T-S.
It becomes a speciality.
It becomes S-E-C-T-S. Sex. Religious sex.
Well, yeah.
Political sex.
Yeah, we know what those are like. They're not very good.
It's part of specialist life that industry brought in. It's an effect. But now we can't have sex. S-E-C-T-S.
We're beyond.
The microphone is the only sect. So whoever has it is everything, and nobody else is there. As Frank said, it doesn't exist unless you're in the media. This is what the kids understand. They got to get in the media.
And this is the emotional effect of doing radio rather than having a conversation in somewhere else, sitting on a park bench.
Now, this, look
you
at
have
that.
A conversation.
You're having a discarnate sex here. We don't know who's listening. Mm-hmm. But I used to think when I got on the radio in the 80s, it was such an incredibly sexy experience. I used to call it the discarnate penis. That I thought everybody needs to be on, democratically, give them a show for half an hour to experience being inside or being the nub of it, then they'd understand why everybody's obsessed with it.
And you have to seduce people. It's like vampirism, you know, of you bite them and then they see the point. Because I would have nothing to do with this radio station when it first appeared. Because the London Musicians Collective produced a magazine. Now, a magazine about music produced by musicians never has anything critical. It was a magazine just full of friends puffing their other...
Each other.
Each other. And it was, to me, there was no honesty or interest in it because it was just a promotional device. So I didn't like Resonance. I didn't want to be involved. But then...
Are you saying it was a magazine originally?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The name was... Yeah. It was the London Musicians Collective had a magazine called Resonance. And then Billy Jenkins, who I'd love to play you his records, is England's greatest guitar... satirist.
Okay, I don't know.
Guitar player and satirist. Has a band called the Voice of God Collective. And he invited me onto his show. And so, because I like him, I came on and we did 2 hours together. And then, of course, I suddenly saw the point. And I started having ideas for shows. And it's the same with when I have guests, particularly they've never done any radio before. And you want me to do a radio program? Oh, I'm really scared. I don't want to do it.
Naive virgin.
And then, but after they've done it, then they start having ideas about doing it.
Doing it.
And it's sort of absurd because you think, well, they're not stupid. They can imagine what a radio station is. It's got microphones. Yeah. It's got a mixing desk. It's broadcast out. But the actual experience of it...
Of being the center of the content going out.
Yeah.
You can't conceive it. But that's content obsession. They can't understand McLuhan until they actually feel the ultimate content generated.
And how are we being deflected now? Why is our conversation different now from... private conversations where the microphones aren't open. What do you think goes
ours
on?
Ours isn't different because we're radio people.
So we just live publicly.
Yeah, we live publicly. The normal people, the pinks, they broadcast themselves as if they're something to something to be received. They think, as once McLuhan is taught arguing with someone, or just this person presenting some ideas to him, and he says, well, you're trying to tell me something. What's wrong with mainstream broadcasting? They're trying to tell people something.
We're just trying to be.
Yeah, we are being.
Yeah.
And so once you've been on the radio...
Yeah, I said this to my favorite poet, Sean Bonney. I said, people get really worried about writing poetry, and they're going to write the best poem ever, and they fiddle around with a silly few words. My idea is that if you live in the correct way, then anything you write is going to be great.
Yeah.
And he didn't agree with that. He went, no. And that no has really stuck with me because I really like his poetry.
Him.
Yeah, and he builds his poetry. He said to me, I can't do what you do, Ben. Every time I'm asked to do a reading, I write something new. I write it out. I have to write it out. I can't improvise poetry because poetry is about this sort of weird thing of you write it down and then you can say it. And there's a dialectic involved with the written page in poetry.
That's
there's also secretly a dialectic involved with score writing and free improvisation that they don't like to talk about too much, but it's definitely there.
But that's you. And then you were saying Sean.
I can't do this sort of improvised verbiage that you spill it all out, and then you go and read it. And I said, well, yeah, I know you can't do that. So that's why your stuff's better than mine. Because he's found a way of thinking a lot about how it works. So it doesn't come out as like fiddled with and repressed. Most people who go and fiddle with their texts after they've written them, you can see
that he's not fiddling.
No, they remind me of people who, you do an abstract expressionist painting and then you go with Tippex and wipe out your errors. No, Sean's doesn't. Sean has got some idea of a.
He's actually improvising like you, but he doesn't do it. He thinks he's doing it differently.
Yeah.
Because when he's building, he's still improvising. No. If he's not correcting.
I think he's got a strong political idea of what his audience
needs.
Need to be told and effects that he can give to them. Yeah. So it's like, it's organizing.
And you don't have an idea, but you do.
I've got no idea what they'll make of it, and I don't care.
Yeah, but then you go and listen to them, and you say, you guys don't know what you're doing. Massive contradictions, Ben, which is okay.
Yeah. No, this isn't worked out at all. The reason I'm telling you about these two methods of producing poetry is because I'm thinking about whether or not, whether we inhabit the radio world and so we open the mics and this is our general conversation, or whether there's any different tilt to what we're saying because the mics are open and we are
not with
radio.
Me.
You don't, not with you.
Yeah. And you know that. I'm just acting with you the way I did when we're off mic. Keeping the same things I'm thinking about.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty authentic. I mean, I I like that idea. I didn't really want performances.
Yeah.
I mean, Derek Bailey was like that. I mean, he found the whole
like
thing...
Like what? You said two
well,
things.
Well, he
like
found
what?
Performance preposterous. He couldn't stand it. And he used to go upstairs to the Little Theatre, and sometimes there was no audience at all, but he'd still play his set.
Yeah.
And they thought he was crazy, but he said, I don't get a chance to play enough.
Yeah.
And here I am, I can play really loud, I can do what I do. And
that's your infantilism, the desire of the infantile to play in the feces or whatever.
Yeah,
that's
what
you like. Yeah. That's one of your aesthetic principles. Now, I come in, you say, Bob, you run a revolution, you got to write a book, which is an interesting statement. You're telling me to write a book.
Am I? When?
It was late last night.
All right, Well, if you wrote a book, I'd be able to like put it in a frame and write a response. I could write a review of your book in which I'd think densely about what you have
to say. I'd give you work.
Yeah, I don't get paid for most reviews that I do, so it's not really a money thing, but it's more, there's a certain...
after image
practice,
of Cambridge.
Practice, you know, which is people produce their book and you read it and you write a review, which is quite a good exchange.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's done properly, you know, where you try to get to the bottom of what the whole argument is, and you produce a response, and I kind of like that, and I like to do it to you.
It's how you talk. It's, you know, Sweeney Agonistes. I got to use words when I talk to you. You're saying I got to write a review of your book when I talk to you. I got to have book when I talk to you.
Yeah.
Now, I would say there's no time for that if you're running something.
Yeah.
And you know
that's good.
And that's your dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I write a book just for Ben to review it? You know?
Well.
And most don't get reviewed. I mean, there's a whole pecking order. Just think of the millions of books are made, no one sees. The guy, the people making them love it.
I've done some of them, so I'm aware of
you're
that.
You're a prime example of this dilemma. You're not successful like me.
Yeah,
You are trying to become visible. I'm successful because I remain unknown.
Yeah, well.
Which is what I state is the I'm a follower of Duchamp in that sense.
But I can write a review of a book even though it's only an edition of one.
Yeah.
I mean, I can... Because it's concentrated the...
Does it have to be a book? Well, can you review my Up the Orfianti essay?
I should be able to review your website, but then I have an economic problem because there's only...
You don't use the web.
I can't because I'm not broadband, and therefore I'm not swanning around there because
I could just print it out and mail you the hard copy, the two essays.
Well, that'd be a book.
Yeah, it'd be a little mini, it'll be a J. W. Curry little 100 edition thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you call his books? Strangelets, booklets? What are those?
We're talking about J. W. Curry.
Now in Ottawa, I just discovered
he's
he books you.
J. W. Curry. And he's.
What do you call the little things he produces?
Well, I don't. I like them. The reason I like them is I don't have a word for them because when they started arriving, the first thing he ever sent to me was. Scrounged paper, recycled paper, sewn together in thread. He'd done a course in Japanese binding with biro written all over everywhere, sort of with a letter to me. It was a letter, but done in this way that was like a little book that he'd made. And then I found that he did this all the time to everybody, and he's producing his art. And you keep J.W. Curry's books because they're so special and fantastic when you get them through the post that everybody's got a little archive of J.W. Curry. And it just seemed like the most fantastic way for an artist to behave. And it makes the whole business of making your name and getting the rich people all buzzed up about this is the next thing. And, you know, it just seems so irrelevant to actually making things which condense his experiences and his arguments, and yet make something that when you show it to someone, they just say, but this is just amazing thing you've handed to me. You know, you've got your hands in amazing
thing. So you live as if you were a tribe in New Guinea and stay within your tribe, quote, primitivist, in the sense that you respect communication on a small scale, and you appreciate this guy's little craft work. That's what the Pre-Raphaelites tried to retrieve. This could be a heavy British meme.
Yeah, but it's not... It's with awareness of what all the crap is going on elsewhere that J.W. Curry isn't...
It's an anti-environment.
He's aware that there's Britney Spears.
He's not a craftsman. He's
Damien
an anti-environment.
Hurst. Yeah, he knows there's Damien Hirst and Britney Spears and Tate Modern and all this big rubbish out there. He knows it's there.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't really want to swap things with somebody who was a naive outsider artist who didn't have any anger about all that. So I preserve some platonic idea of the big abstraction somewhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Even though the best method seems to be to turn your back on it, but you are turning your back on something. And there are people who go around, you know, they make pretty things. They don't know that there's this battle, or they don't have the imagination about it. And I find that trivial. That's not interesting.
Now, Ben, we know that's half of you. The other half is looking for a fight and for the revolution. And J.W. is filling in while we're waiting for the fight. You do want to have a fight, right?
Mm.
You know, and I that's do, the other
yeah.
part.
Yeah.
But how would
J.W. you... Curry wants to have a fight.
Oh, does he?
Is he
a Trotskyist or something like that?
He's practical. I heard a description of his behavior at a poetry conference, and it was such the perfect critique of academia, of actually doing it.
Okay.
And it was, he's at a poetry conference, and what he does is he talks to people in the print room in the university complex, and they take over this print room and start producing books. And the people who work in the print room start having ideas and producing books, and they get this photocopier working, and they're just producing poetry books. And he includes them, and the pecking order people are just freaked out by this.
That
this isn't what you should be doing.
We don't want to include the employees.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're not poets. They're just people hanging around. And
so that's like going into the factory and getting the workers excited.
It's like an occupation, isn't
it?
It's like when everybody... Because that's when love... and hope and all the good things really start happening is during revolutionary times, when we seize the things that make stuff, and we allow our trust in each other to be the social network rather than all the money worry and anxiety.
Was that the charisma of the early mothers?
No.
They didn't have that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think they're a revolution. I mean, this is May 68 in Paris, or it's 1917, or it's Portugal in 74. These are revolutionary moments. The Zappa thing is it's like a commentary on everything. It's like trying to produce something in a petri dish of dropping germs in and being very aware of it. And it's fascinating. It's so interesting that you can't not look into it. But I'd never hold it up as a utopian, you know, prevision.
He's not a J.W. Curry going into the factory.
No. No, he's not J.W. Curry. No, he's got a whole bourgeois composer complex thing.
Yeah.
And he works through it in a way that sheds light on that. And
I think it comes out of his poverty, lower middle class, lower class, whatever poverty.
Yeah.
He did want to become an American in that sense, not a European.
Yeah.
Sociologically speaking, that's what he was. I mean, Nigel Lennon, people say, he was very old-fashioned.
Yeah, they say that his line on communism was sort of like an anti-communism lecture at school from the 50s. You know, sort of, you're not allowed to have anything.
Well, do you know that, you know, how he has in his autobiography the theory of his father, everything comes out of Sicily?
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
I met a lot of people the last 7 days, whatever it's been. Someone presented that to me the other day. They had the details on how it was Sicily. Oh, I know. It was that Robert Bridge guy. He knew a woman who was an Albanian who explained that it all came from Sicily and then went to Naples.
Yeah.
Which I thought, well, man, maybe that's what Mr.
Well, Sicily
Zappa knew.
Is sort of nearly the middle of the Mediterranean, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, if the Mediterranean is all this
crisscrossing. It's like a Venice. It's the lower Venice.
It's all this crisscrossing trade and communication. Then
the
Sicily
lower Venice.
Pretty important.
Yeah, that the lower Venice. Venice it was down here doing another.
Well,
Venice.
Venice is when you start exporting it to the north, isn't it? So you've got all those routes up there.
So the Naples, the Sicily is the Venice of the south.
The thing I thought you were going to say, talking about his dad, was the way his dad was very skeptical about written history.
Yeah.
And had a whole
oral
thing that you can't believe what they write down. And that skepticism in Frank about the written as opposed to the stories people tell is just it's an amazing bouleversement of your world, particularly if you've been very committed to books.
Yeah.
It's the opposite.
But you know what he did? He argued with his father's love of Shakespeare. So the oral man worships the literary man on some level.
Yeah. Well, Shakespeare is pretty Finnegan's Wake-ish.
Yeah.
I mean,
so maybe that's what he saw.
I mean, Finnegan's Wake, I mean, Shakespeare is the transcription. The way I look at it is the transcription of events, which were the plays, which were situations created by everybody.
Yeah.
And somebody wrote down all the stuff that William was getting them to say. It wasn't William sucking his pencil and writing it all out cold.
That's Francis Bacon.
It's a transcription of of this event, which enabled all these people to get really articulate.
It's oral culture.
Yeah, so in a sense, it is oral culture.
I showed my own bias. I thought he meant written Shakespeare. He might have meant Shakespeare plays. Well, not the books.
They're written to be resounded. There's a whole... Yep. I have a whole problem with it. When I write my poetry, it comes out in blank verse because we played Shakespeare at school and I used to be worried about it. You know, I've got to get away from this. I've got to, it's too traditional. But then I think that's the way the English language just boom. That's the way it sounds loud. That's how you can get it working. So that's good.
So how's Zappa against the oral presentation of...
When I went mad, I believe that Frank Zappa was a new Shakespeare and worked in a way which was to go to a particular spot he'd never been before. He'd work his way up. He'd sit in a pub, meet a few people. He'd have some money that allowed him to ask them to do this and that. And then he'd create a sort of crazy situation where everyone would find partners and lovers. Like the end of Shakespeare play, everyone's married off. Yeah. You know, the hero and heroine, but then also the sort of ugly one finds an ugly partner, and everybody's married off. And Zappa would do that, and the end product would be an album. And everybody thought he was producing records. But this was
theater.
He was actually producing situations in cities by working with what he could work with. He was like, an entrepreneur or something that came in and
like J.W. Curry creating a workshop. Isn't that kind of similar?
Well, J.W.
Curry... You have walked into the opposite side here.
I'm trying to get back to a point that wasn't finished being
made. Well, we're talking about the father. Naples.
And his skepticism about written history and the how deep that is and what a shock it is that Zappa is a very carefully constructed shock for the literary the sort of person.
The Grant economy.
And, you know, the apprentice studied literature at Oxford, you know. And
you hear what I said? The Grant economy. He was a critic of that.
The
Grant, G-R-A-N-T-S.
What's Grant?
Well, you know, in North America, and I guess here, all the art groups live on grants.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely.
What do you call them? Maybe you don't say the word grant.
What do I call them? Craven, fun-seeking crumbsuckers.
Yeah, they get the crumbs.
They are the plague. They are the death.
Yeah.
They are why the art world has nothing interesting in it.
Mm.
And Frank is very good on the art world about his committees of white wine drinkers. There is absolutely nothing... Resonance occasionally has programs like this with artists sitting around talking, and the emotional atmosphere of these people talking to each other is poison.
Mm.
There's something around the art world about arguing for what you do, my work.
They don't know they're on the radio. They're really showing the unconsciousness of the medium.
They have to be stopped. Art must be stopped because it's absolutely complicit with...
Oh, you agree with me.
Things.
You believe in shutting down art, yeah.
Absolutely.
Is that right wing? Cut the funding? That's what they attempted.
Yeah, I know.
But
I
they mean, were doing I, it for I mean, backward I mean, reasons.
I find it difficult to...
What the heck is your socialism or Marxism? Would it be almost anarchistic? I mean, what is it?
It's revolutionary Marxism, so I believe in workers' councils. So I believe in this sort of J.W. Curry thing, and the people where they work taking over... And their freedom, I've tasted it in supporting strikes and so on. You go down as a Trotskyist sort of political agent, but you get involved with this whole sort of festival of what people can be.
Yeah.
And the kind of hacks that I used to work with who weren't that good at actually talking to people but had all the politics would be amazing because I'd go down there and, of course, I'd start talking to them about things like Frank Zappa or the Sex Pistols, and with music you can communicate
with
people.
You had things to talk about, you're saying.
That there's a whole... The people I met during the hospital strike in the early 80s in Leeds, they were the ones who were going down to these women who were... They were heterosexual, but they had to go to the gay clubs because only there they were free of all the usual nonsense. And they were people, they were trying to live.
Yeah.
And going on strike was their attempt to really live and not just survive and to criticise everybody. And the...
So you were the poet coming into this living organism and doing poetry by just bringing up topics that made them think about what they were doing.
Well, no, I was somebody who was forced to go along there because I was convinced of the politics of the Revolutionary Party. They said, we've got to go along to picket lines. But what you actually find on picket lines, of course, is actually people realizing we don't have to put up with all this nonsense. We can run it all ourselves.
Yeah.
And when it gets more, when other people have heard of the strike and they start supporting it, and when you suddenly realize a lorry driver decided not to cross the picket line, he's in charge of this massive machine and he can turn it around, go away again and do what you want. Yeah. And you start to think all this stuff around us could be used for us, in a good way. And it's funny, the size of vehicles is really important. I noticed on the anti-war demonstrations that if a mini car honked to horn, we'd cheer, but if a 10-ton truck and the driver honks his horn, everybody on the demo goes bananas. They love it because it's all that's on our side. All
that's
that
the extension. See, that's our self joining in. Our extended machine self.
Yeah.
Now, what has happened to all that? Is it just pockets of temporary autonomous zones, or is that not happened? Does it not happen anymore?
Well, it seems to be. I'm getting more. I keep tripping over protests, and things are hotting up on that.
Yeah.
In that area, they definitely are
now because then everything's disappeared.
Well, because prices are going up, and they won't give us any money, and what I mean. But I'm taking Iris to Treetops, which is a very nice place for kids to climb around in Kentish Town, and the Unison have got a magazine. I look into it. It's all kind of socialist worker type. Mm-hmm. I know all the names, but they've got the pamphlet there of this lefty union sort of denouncing everybody and everything, mm-hmm. and sort of just there for taking away for all the parents. That's surfacing. That's a breath of something. When I say to the woman who's been nice to me about some problem, oh, it's nice we've got some lefty propaganda around, she smiles at me. Well, 10 years ago, that wouldn't
Is that right?
So there's something bubbling over, and Didier Mervollet, the general secretary of Les Fils de l'Invention, who's politically, once he did just decided I was so raw and Marxist and unsophisticated and believe in workers' councils, and things have got more complex than that, and he was sort of to the right of me. Now he's excited by students in France, and he's giving talks to them, and we're going to present a on the 10th of May at Conway Hall. There's something organized about May 68,
right.
And Didier and me, we're going to take the bull by the horns. We're going to talk about Frank Zappa in May 68, and of course conventional opinion will be he didn't like the German, he's a reactionary capitalist, but we're going to explain to everybody.
Didn't we say 10 minutes ago he had nothing to do with that?
Well, absolutely. He didn't. I mean, he was critical of it, But this discussion is the heart of head, heart. Without this discussion, all is boring nonsense. That this debate around Adorno's there. I mean, Adorno and Zappa agree. They're both very critical of the revolting students. You can't. Their positions are very similar. And simply saying, well, you've got to cheerlead everything the students do is kind of crazy because they didn't win. So we've got to think about what they did. And and because Zappa hones in on the subjective
side.
He's
a critique of it. He gives something to talk about.
The idea of revolution is we get rid of the difference between subject and object. Well, the people talk objectively about left-wing politics. Where's the subject? Where's the thing you want to do? If that isn't there, how can we motivate anyone? It's a moralistic, boring, thing that's like a ways on the left, like a.
So Zappa was a magnified subjective expression to create a dialogue, to create an anti-environment, temporary, like Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah, yeah,
he was Lewis.
Though, politically, I kind of prefer Frank to Wyndham.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's after the blues, The blues was such a contribution to...
Music is the best. You can't beat music.
I mean, it democratized and it globalized in ways that from a literature... Trying to be the absolute overthrow of literature. I mean, blast, it's like seeing what newspapers could be. But Wyndham Lewis is, I think he's the oaf of theory.
Right. But did you get my point? Music is the best?
Yeah.
It's very powerful, potent force.
Well, I mean, it was visual in the 20s, the revolution, modern art.
Yeah.
In the 60s, it was musical.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now it's tactile. Digital is tactile. Well, interface, my face.
Yeah, but I don't find the digital revolution. I don't get it.
I don't know if you know this. The anti-environment to a culture, to the kids living in MySpace, interfacing all the time. You know what they do when they go party? They dance not facing each other. Do you have that over here? This is how they dance. The woman gets her, the young girl gets like that, and the guy gets behind and basically...
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's the a blues. You call that in Leeds, in Chapeltown, in the Caribbean, Jamaican area. That's their way
is
of dancing.
Is it Mardi Gras kind of dancing?
No, that's sort of carnival-esque down the street. But it's very packed, and you've got big speakers, and it's reggae, and that's how you dance. And it's dark, so that you can really... You're practically...
It's called grinding in North
America.
Yeah,
you're practically doing it.
Right. So the point is that they do not do interfacial contact when they're dancing, because that's what they live every day. That's their work, interfacing, intertexting. So they don't face each other as a release.
Yeah.
Why that fad comes in. Mm. It responds to the sensory. It's not even a fad. It's just a sensory response to the other daily sensory interaction of disconnect intertexting.
All right. You mean that you can get the little camera on your computer. You've got a face changing not very quickly, sort of
Facebook.
In the corner.
Facebook, MySpace, face.
But you're finding the dialectical opposite of what the digital media do.
Yeah.
But then when you... I always have this with you. When you start talking about it, you go, but it's the digital media. And I'm thinking, he's a cyber booster. I can't get...
being enthusiastic. I'm explaining it enthusiastically, but I'm not... It's like McLuhan used to say, I never approve of what I talk about. So I'm excited about what the meaning of what I think I'm communicating, but it doesn't mean I promote it. Actually, I'm diminishing it by saying, look, here's a reaction to it.
Yeah.
So we don't need to look at the digital media. Look at the translation. Mm-hmm. Grinding. Mm.
But it's so important. When I wanted to criticize Deleuze and Guattari, I wanted to talk about some reception among a particular set of people.
Yeah.
The theory does not exist in is it true or is it not. You've got to look at people's needs and why they should adopt something. And for me, Deleuze and Guattari are like the Doors. They're an adolescent transitional thing. You've left the family and you come to this hostile world where you need a job. And Deleuze and Guattari are perfect. You know, they fit for that, which is why, of course, they're not philosophy, because philosophy doesn't appeal to a particular... Yeah. Set is trying to think everything, so it's not going to, you know, sell to them.
Yeah.
It's history is actually made by people. This is Vico. No.
And we made the digital space.
Yeah.
Slavery helped create conditions.
Now I want to read some Finnegan's Wake. I want to read that paragraph.
Okay.
That you talk about that nearly has Marshall McLuhan's name.
Yeah. Page 254.
Because I think I read out rather differently from you. Maybe I should.
And then we'll do the page 614, maybe.
Yeah, 254. Yeah.
The top.
It's the top. Was he pitched for an example as certain have dogged nose of him against our seawall by Rory, Thwath and Cleaver, those three stout sweenhearts, Orion of the Orgias, Mirashal MacMuin, the Ipsy Dadden, product of the extremes, giving quotidians to our means, as might occur to anyone, your Brutus Lehrman with the Princess Champion Archdeaconry, or so yclept from Cleo's clippings, which the Concher of Chivalries is suspicious save his scan, for ancients link with presence as the human chain extends, have done, do, and will again, as John Polycarp and our news eye to eye, eye witnessed, and to Paddy Palmer, while monks sell you to archers, or the water of the Livian goes the way of all fish, from Sarah's drawhead, the quarrelsome, to Isaac's, the laughed but one, with a minilisp exterior to his monolothin turn. So Pericon with Bastien, or Heavy Humph with Airy Nan, Rickaracka, Brimmer, Billy, Jicky, Jocky, Jocky, Jolly, Jollycass, how somst thou, Dulcissimica, and ah, ab, ad, abu, abiad, a babble men dub gulch of tears. Would you like to do some?
Oh, I'd like to exegete that.
Okay. Yeah, exegete it. That's a good idea. And we'll probably be finishing with that.
We got, what, 9 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, this is a section that Marshall McLuhan thought described him. Top of page 254, Finney's Wake. And I've seen, and I have Xeroxes of Marshall's copies of Finney's Wake, and he put opposite the Marshall McLuhan, me, meaning himself.
Yeah.
So he understood that this This was the linguistic...
Well, he thought it meant himself. Actually, it meant militant aesthetics.
Yes. No, it's true. Here comes everybody. But the thing is that it does the language, Joyce... The linguistic unconscious predicted McLuhan, and it's his exact method and his theory, what he's known as, theoretically. Was he pitched for an example? In other words, was he looking for an example? As certain have diagnosed. Now,
Well, I hear that. Was he pissed, for example?
No, that's okay. Drunk. Yeah. I just wanted to show, bring it in. McLuhan was always looking, they said he was obsessed with metaphor. So I'm thinking of that as example, looking for examples. But diagnosed. McLuhan was a Menippean satirist. Technically, Menippeanism comes from the philosophy, Diogenes' philosophy of cynicism. And their symbol was the dog. So McLuhan, like Zappa and Joyce and Lewis, didn't diagnose. They dognosed. They presented themes for you as any environment. They satirized you because you were looking for a diagnosis. So they dognosed. And Osmic, the nose, the sniffing, Fido.
Yeah.
Right there in dognosed.
Yeah.
As certain have... dognosed of him against our sea wall. Now, isn't that the watershed?
No, it's a seawall. Well, it sounds more like an attempt to keep the sea. I mean, a seawall is keeping something away, isn't it?
And he's against it.
Yeah.
He's against our sea wall.
Oh, he's totally against that. I mean, Joyce, that quote from Parnell that gets punned on throughout Finnegan's Wake about how can anyone set the bounds to the marches of a nation.
Yep.
And it's against these borders and these carving up the world as nation states.
And the seawall is created by Ruri, Thoth, and Cleaver. Thoth would be the wall that the phonetic alphabet created. All for a bit, Balbus is building a wall.
Thoth, the god of writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Cleaver. Those three stout swain hearts, Orion of the Orgias. Now, the 60s was an orgy, and Baudrillard wrote about it, a famous essay after that, 70s, 80s, called After the Orgy, and the exhaustion. So McLuhan is there, like Zappa in the Life magazine article, enters the orgiastic disco and says, what if someone interrupted your dancing and presented a diagnosis of the situation and whether we could use this ourselves as powerful force? McLuhan was like that. He was an interrupter of the pleasure. So Orion of the Orgias, Myrtle McMuhan, the Ipsy Dadden. Now, Mechanical Bride, his first book, is based on Duchamp's New Descending Staircase. Is that what it is?
The painting or the...
The painting, the New Descending...
Not the Bride Strip Bear.
No, the New Descending Staircase, 1914 or whatever it was. The Ipsy Dadden, I see Dada in there. Dadden, Daddy. Product of the Extremes... Now, he was seen as an extremist, a technological determinist, who was giving quotidians or making it cliché to our means. Our means are our media. How is our means of communication? So he was a product of the extremes, giving quotidians to our means. That's the book from cliché to archetype, from the quotidian to the means or the extreme. As might occur to anyone. If you explain people to McLuhan, you start saying, you know, the book's an extension of the eye. Of course. That's obvious. You get that reaction all the time from neophytes. You know what I mean? What's the point here? Yeah, so what? You know? So he's taking these trivial perceptions and making them extreme, saying they're the be-all, end-all, the clue to a hidden social change. Mm-hmm. These things that might occur to anyone, but they never did occur to anybody.
It's very Benjaminian, that.
Yes. He was a friend of Siegfried Gideon, and so was Joyce. Gideon is a key guy in McLuhan land.
It's these, you call it trivial, but it's these immediate observations, which kind of this is why gamma helps.
Yeah.
That everyone gets too sophisticated to make. So seeing what people are actually doing, sort of through all the kind of...
He grunts. The ground of what we're doing. He reminds us.
Mm.
So... This that might occur to anyone, your Brutus layman. Now, he was a layman professor at a Catholic university. Most of the teachers were priests. With the princiest champion in our archdeaconry.
So he was there? Marshall McLuhan?
Yeah, he was a layman at St. Michael's, a Basilian college.
Right.
Right. And he and Don Thiel, there weren't too many of them. They got paid nothing. It was in the 50s. And the majority of teachers were priests. So he's a layman with the princess champion in our archdeaconry. Or so eclipsed from Clio's clippings. When I did McLuhan's archives, organized them, all his writings from all the different period, a lot of it was newspaper clippings. Now, Joyce doesn't mean this, but when we know what McLuhan did, the language anticipates his method. So, or so eclipsed from Clio's clippings, it even gets better, which the cruncher of chivalries, he was a medievalist. That's what his grounding was at Cambridge in the 30s. The cruncher of chivalries is suspicious, save he scanned. He emphasized that the TV camera, TV monitor, was a scanning mechanism, okay? And he said it retrieves medieval sensibility. So he was the cruncher. In other words, he diagnosed. He said, okay, we're going medieval because of TV. But he wasn't for that. Everybody thought he was for that. He crunched it, if you really saw what he was doing. Which the cruncher of chivalries is suspicious, save he scan. Save can be accept he scan or whatever the other meaning of save is suspicious. For ancients link with presents, and that was his thesis. This thesis was about the ancients versus the moderns, his PhD thesis. And he said that the vorticists, Pound, Lewis, Joyce, especially Pound and Joyce, believed that or acted as if all times were happening via the medium of language. So the ancients link with the presents. You get that? For ancients link with presents as the human chain extends. There's the McLuhan word, extensions of man. And he says, as the human chain extends, have done, do, and will again. And then he goes into the eye-ear with the eye-to-eye, eye-witnessed. And then it goes into other things. But I think that's pretty crystal. The other quote...
Yeah, no, we don't have time for that. I just want to say... something, which is that...
Can I read a sentence from you, A Bow Finnegan's Wake? Page 58, it's just short, but it fits in. You go, Finnegan's Wake, this is page 58 of your Art Cleavage book, Finnegan's Wake was a much more realistic assessment of the power, quote, the power of literature in 1934, as simultaneously useless and necessary as dream work. That's a very good statement. It's a preliminary... to understanding McLuhan's take on the Wake.
The way you expound it reminds...
The way you expound the page...
The way you expounded it, the way you find your...
My Rorschach
your particular method sort of enshrined, sort of worked out in there, reminds me of how I've used Schwitters.
Yeah.
And that if I kind of wrote like that about what I think Schwitters does, I would be describing thinking and I would be able to... sort of expound everything that I thought thinking actually is.
If you did Finneganese on Schwitters.
Yeah. If I thought about when you find an artist who cuts right, it makes you articulate.
Yeah.
And that's the academic approach to art can't do that because it makes it an object which you then become an expert on and you keep it dead.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do is actually make the get the art to do what it should do, which is stimulate us into articulacy.
McLuhan's thesis was that we need to retrieve the rhetorical grammarian tradition that you aren't wise unless you're eloquent. And eloquent can be updated to articulation. That's exactly his point. That's why in your books you expound, and maybe the Cambridge influence or something, where he came from, McLuhan came from, you're expounding the wisdom... And the principle of the vortices is just that I add the update of, quote, new media. But you've got the grounding as a literate person.
All right. Well, it's
with an oral bias. You're an underminer of the non-tactile. You're a tactile, Ben.
Okay. All right. Well, I accept that. This is, we're very near the end of our show. I want to thank Bob Dobbs very much for coming to London over the last few days and putting my head in the whirl, and I've just found it really stimulating time, you know. And this is
well, that's what stimulating. What?
This is helping me think, you know. Yeah. It really helps.
And so when I get that,
I just hope that people have enjoyed this rather than just thinking that
we're wankers, which is what we're doing.
Completely insane.
But I want to say, Ben, I enjoy someone responding. Okay. That's where I get right. Life.
Good. And just to say that if you like what you heard and want to hear me again, I'll be playing music rather than
a lot of words. It's Wednesday at 2 is when I do my show. And Bob, do you want to say anything about people want to follow up your website or something like that?
Go to fivebody.com. I think eventually this conversation will be on there, but it's all kinds of other stuff, and it gives a clue to how I'm going to take over the world.
Right. Good.
Well, maybe the worlds. Plural. Plural. Worlds.
Yeah.
Or how it was done. I already did
it. Right. Now we go over to shuffle mode for the rest of the night. Resonance will get off shuffle mode and start having proper stuff tomorrow morning.
Resonance FM 104.4 London. Resonance FM 104.4 London's first radio art station.